new chief hiring confirmed for Council Bluffs Police Department. Council Bluffs will soon have a new police chief. The Council Bluffs City Council voted unanimously Monday to approve Mayor Matt Walsh's appointment of Matthew Davis as the city's new police chief. Davis comes to Council Bluffs after working his way up the ranks of the Illinois State Police over the past 25 years. From trooper to his current position as first deputy director, the highest-ranking sworn position in the agency. Davis was appointed to the job by Illinois State Police Director Brendan Kelly in February 2019. He's articulate, knowledgeable, has a lot of common sense, Walsh said about Davis. He has a wealth of experience. He is certainly up for the task. And I think he'll be a great replacement for Tim Carmody, unquote. A native of Chicago suburb, Berwyn, Illinois, Davis attended the University of Delaware, where he earned a bachelor's degree in anthropology and history. He then attended Northern Illinois University, where he earned a master's degree in anthropology. Davis then joined the Illinois State Police in 1998. In 2006, while working for ISB, Davis also earned his law degree from St. Louis University School of Law. We put together two interview panels, mostly city employees. The president of the Citizen/Police Advisory Board, the chairman of the Civil Service Commission, and the member of the community who has a law enforcement background. Walsh said he went through the interview process and it was unanimous in that I didn't hear anyone propose someone other than Matt Davis, so that kind of made the decision easy, unquote. Davis is expected to wrap up his duties at Illinois in early November and start his new position on or around November 20th, Walsh said. The Council Bluffs City Council vote to approve Davis's hiring was 4-0, with Council Member Chris Peterson absent. Carmody retired September 11th after 40 years in law enforcement. He had been chief since 2014. New Visions Homeless Services to host Council Bluffs City Council Candidate Forum. Council Bluffs residents will have an opportunity to get to meet candidates for City Council at a candidate forum Sunday, hosted by New Visions Homeless Services. Affordable housing and homelessness are two main issues our community is facing, and this will give the candidates time to state how they would address these issues. New Visions President and CEO Waller said, looking at communities that are having an impact in providing solutions to homelessness and affordable housing, there is a strong working relationship between local government, nonprofits, and community members. All six candidates vying for three open council seats, Christopher Carey, Joe DiSalvo, Kimberly Kowalski, Pat Miller, Roger Sadow, and Jill Chudak, have been invited to participate in the forum. DiSalvo and Sandow are both incumbents looking to retain their seats. Council member Chad Hannon chose not to run for the second term. It is important that the candidates are willing to work together with the community to make sure everyone who calls our community their home has a safe and affordable place to go at night, Waller said. The forum is being held on Sunday, October 29th from 2 to 4 p.m. at the New Visions campus, 1435 North 15th Street. Election day is November 7th. Polls are open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. Early voting is available at Pottawatomie Country Courthouse during regular business hours. For more election information, visit elections.pottcounty-ia.gov. SWIPCO, or SWIPCO, welcomes three new employees. The Southwest Iowa Planning Council recently welcomed three new employees. Julie Hayes joins SWIPCO as a transit scheduler. Hayes will be a part of the team that connects area residents to the transportation they need. SWITA, S-W-I-T-A, serves eight countries in Southwest Iowa with a fleet of 100 vehicles. Transportation provided includes work routes, student transportation, day habilitation, routes for disabled individuals, medical transport, and a range of other services. I can see that this is a valuable and much-needed service area, Hayes said. This job was appealing to me since it was an opportunity to stay in customer service. Hayes has a background in customer service with Hy-Vee Wine and Spirits, Johnson Brothers Wine, and Nutrien AG Solutions. To find out more about the transportation services provided by SWTA, call 712-243-2518 or 1-800-842-8065 or find more information at SWTA.com. Barb Boggs joins SWPCO as a grant specialist. She will work with SWPCO Disaster Recovery, planning to help the citizens claims and surveying for the agency. Boggs will help clients navigate through application procedures and ensure the agency is meeting grant regulations. SWPCO and the Southwest Iowa Housing Trust Fund operate a wide range of programs, including housing repair, down payment insurance, demolition, dilapidated houses, and lead abatement. SWPCO also provides building inspection services and currently has more than 1,500 rental units in its inspection program. Boggs will assist with all of these programs and will be an asset to the agency. Boggs has lived the majority of her life in Atlantic and graduated from Atlantic High School. She has a varied background in work in financing, a law office, the Postal Service, and more. I enjoy helping people and look forward to doing a lot of that with this position, Boggs said. Chris Parks joins SWPCO as a communications coordinator. Parks will oversee community outreach, public engagement, and media communications for SWPCO, Southwest Iowa Transit Agency. He will work to increase awareness of SWPCO projects and public transit services to better connect the people of Southwest Iowa region to employment, school, and wherever they need to go. Parks is a graduate of Glenwood High School and has a bachelor's degree in broadcasting from the University of Nebraska at Kearney. He has a wealth of journalism experience as a broadcaster for 16 years at KGN Radio in Atlantic. Parks lives in Atlantic with his wife, Mandy, and their two children. Southwest Iowa has been home for me for most of my life, and I've been lucky enough to have a great connection with many people in the region. From my upbringing, the time with KJAN, Parks said, SWPCO is involved with so many things that make life better for residents of the region, and I am excited to have the opportunity to share those stories and help people connect with the services they need. Council Bluffs Neighbors, obituaries for October 25th, 2023. Leland Lou. Lou Leland, or Luann Carlson Leland, was born April 3rd, 1934, and passed away October 16th, 2023. Luann Carlson Leland died at the Dahmer Care Center in Belleville, Illinois, on Monday, October 16th, 2023. After a brief stay, she had lived for 35 years in O'Fallon, Illinois, and was in failing health for a year. She was born in Fort Dodge, Iowa, on April 3, 1934. The daughter of Mary Rita and Louis Henry Carlson, Luann grew up in Council Bluffs, Iowa, and was graduated in 1952 from the former St. Francis High School in Council Bluffs, where she received many honors. She retired from AT&T in 1987 after a 28-year career and continued her professional life for many years by the Chapter 13th Bankruptcy Trustee for Southern Illinois in Swansea, Illinois, and then for another 9 years as a sales representative for McBride Homes, the largest home builder in St. Louis metropolitan region. Luann's son, daughters, and husband were always her highest priorities. She had many friends in O'Fallon, Council Bluffs, and Washington Courthouse, Ohio, the hometown of her husband, John. In the final weeks of her life, she continued to flash her gentle smile and maintain her cheerful disposition. Luann Carlson Leland was preceded in death by her parents and brothers, Edward Carlson, Robert Carlson, Richard Carlson, and Donald Carlson. Luann is survived by her husband, John Woodmansey Leland of O'Fallon, Illinois, and her children, Kevin Matthew Marr, of Omaha, Nebraska, Mary Rita Peterson of Norman, Oklahoma, and Jean Mary Miner, Tim, as he was also known, of Irving, California. Grandchildren, Nathan John Peterson, Kaylee of Kansas, Missouri, Nicholson Scott Peterson, or Courtney, Norman, Oklahoma, Nolan Patrick Peterson, married to Raven, Norman, Oklahoma, William Miner, Irving, or Irvine, California, Caitlin Miner, Phoenix, Arizona, five great-grandchildren, brother Tom, spouse of Diane, of Lincoln, Nebraska, nieces and nephews. The family extends special thanks to Jai Smith, Luann's devoted caregiver in the final months of her life. Mass of Christian burial, Tuesday, October 24th, 2023, at 1 p.m. at St. Patrick Catholic Church in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Interment in St. Joseph Cemetery with a lunch following at St. Patrick's Church and Social Hall. Recitation of the Rosemary, Monday, October 23rd, 2023, at 6 p.m., followed by visitation with the family until 8 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill, Meyer, Woodring, Bayless Park. Chapel memorials may be made to BJC Hospice, 2220 South State Route 157, Suite 300, Glen Carbon, Illinois, 62034, or to the charity of the donor's choice. Lori L. Leemaster was born May 28, 1953, and passed away October 22, 2023. Lori L. Leemaster, age 70, of Council Bluffs, passed away October 22, 2023, in Missouri Valley, Iowa. Lori was born May 28, 1953, in Omaha, Nebraska, to Billy and Jeanne Butterfield Blunk. Lori graduated from Lewis Central High School with the class of 1971. During high school, Lori was cheerleader and participated in the marching band for many years after graduation. She continued to serve on the planning committee for her class reunions. She also enjoyed art and was a very good seamstress. On November 10th, 2000, Lori and Stan Leemaster were united in marriage in St. Lucia, Caribbean Island. She was preceded in death by her father, Billy Blunk, on May 24th, 2009. Lori is survived by her husband, Stan, daughter Carrie Harris, mother Jeanne Blunk, sister Susie Bauman, all of Council Bluffs' grandchildren, Ben and Zane Leemaster, Jillian, Vivian, and Zachary Gay, stepson Scott, spouse of Eve Leemaster of Bentonville, Arizona, stepdaughter Jennifer Leemaster Gay of Dallas, Texas, niece Sarah Turner, great nieces Brittany and Lucy Turner, and beloved coonhound Willow. Visitation Monday, October 30th, 2023, from 5 to 6 p.m., followed by funeral service at 6 p.m., all at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home. Following the services, for Lori, her favorite menu of Pizza King pizza and cheesecake will be served in the Cutler O'Neill Community Room. Patricia J., or Patty as she was better known, Schmidecki, July 10th, 1957 was her birthday, and she passed away October 22nd, 2023. Patricia J., or Patty as she was better known, Schmidecki, age 66, passed away October 22nd, 2023, at Midlands Living Center in Council Bluffs. Patty was born July 10th, 1957 in Council Bluffs to the late and Rose Eric Schmidecki. Patty graduated from Underwood High School with the class of 1976. She worked many years in the restaurant business. She is preceded in death by her parents, Max and Rose. Survivors include son, Tyler Lambertson, and wife, Sarah of Suffolk, Virginia, and grandson, James Lambertson, and many cousins. Memorial service, Friday, 1 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home. Patty will be laid to rest with her parents at Fisher Cemetery in Underwood, Iowa. Last ramp reopened at I-29 and I-480 interchange in Council Bluffs. Finally, you can get there from here. Last week, the Iowa Department of Transportation simplified travel from Council Bluffs to downtown Omaha when it reopened the ramp connecting southbound Interstate 29 with westbound Interstate 480. It's the first time in almost 2 years that the interchange connecting the neighboring Missouri River cities has been fully open, and it heralds the approaching end of the 15-year, $1.5 billion reconstruction of the interstate network in Council Bluffs. That's a whole milestone on the Council Bluffs Interstate project, said Scott Sir, district transportation planner for the Iowa DOT. The larger project begun in 2008 straightens out a lot of quirks in the original design of I-29, I-480, Interstate 80, and the ramps that connect them, Sure said. We had a lot of right-hand merges. We've eliminated them throughout the corridor, he said. We've eliminated traffic weaving as a system. It's a lot safer. The other major problem was the lack of access to West Broadway Council Bluffs, major east-west artery. Iowa DOT has now corrected that with the reconstruction of the I-29, I-480 interchange. Now there is a direct link from I-29 to downtown Council Bluffs and a smoother link to downtown Omaha. It did not come without pain. The interchange closed in November of 2021, along with the northbound lanes of I-29 between Nebraska Avenue and Avenue G. 4 months later, southbound lanes were also closed between Nebraska Avenue and North 25th Street. During the closures, traffic was diverted to newly built frontage just below the highway superstructure. Dynamic messaging signs warned drivers of the detour. Engineers considered keeping the freeway open while the interchange was rebuilt, Scher said, but it would have boosted the cost of the $180 million project and taken up to 6 years instead of two. The freeway reopened in August, along with the ramp from Nebraska Avenue to northbound I-29 and two ramps to south I-29. Construction will continue on the I-80 interchange at Madison Avenue until 2026, the final piece of the puzzle of the Council Bluffs interchange project. Some roadwork will continue near I-29, 2nd Avenue between the north and south frontage roads. Beneath the freeway is closed for reconstruction until November 10th. Other projects, the South Expressway from I-80 to 19th Avenue in Council Bluffs will be rebuilt until November 30th, with lane closures expected while one-lane traffic is maintained in each direction. Lane reconstructions are in place on South 3rd Street between Story Street and 9th Avenue in Council Bluffs until Friday because of water main installation. South 3rd Street between 9th Avenue and Worth Street is closed entirely until Wednesday as part of the same project. South 35th Street between Veterans Memorial Highway and Middle Ferry Road in Council Bluffs is closed as part of the Gifford Road reconstruction project until November 17th. Trail Ridge Street between Grand Avenue and Crestwood Drive in Council Bluffs is closed for reconstruction until November 30th. Cub Scouts clean Valley View Park. 712 Initiative Supports Youth Service Project. Two dens from Cub Scout Pack 15 helped clean up the Valley View Park on Monday, October 16th as part of their community service projects. Lions kindergartners, led by leaders Megan Wirtz and Miranda Porter, and Bears third graders, led by den leaders Jamie Young and Trevor Wirtz, teamed up to collect trash along with 712 Initiative, which supplied grabbers, gloves, and garbage bags. Pack 15's clubmaster Sarah Young said, Navigator officially withdraws Iowa pipeline permit request. Navigator CO2 withdrew its petition in Iowa for a hazardous liquid pipeline permit on Monday, after announcing last week that it was canceling its project. The company had proposed to build a 1,350-mile pipeline system in 5 states to transport captured carbon dioxide from ethanol plants and other facilities to Illinois for underground sequestration or other commercial purposes. Last month, Navigator asked the Iowa Utilities Board to suspend its permit process. That followed a decision by utility regulators in South Dakota to deny the company a permit. On Friday, the company announced it was abandoning the project because of the unpredictable nature of the regulatory and government process, unquote. A company spokesperson further said potential legislation that could alter state rules that govern the pipelines added another layer of uncertainty. Navigator was one of the 3 companies that proposed to build carbon dioxide pipelines in Iowa. Summit Carbon Solutions is nearing the end of its permit process in Iowa, but was denied permits in North and South Dakota, which has delayed its project timeline. Summit initially hoped to have its system operational sometime next year, but the company said last week it would not likely be in operation until 2026 if Summit is able to get permits from the states. North Dakota regulators have agreed to reconsider Summit's permit request, and the company has said it will reapply in South Dakota. Spokesperson Wolf Carbon still hopes to avoid eminent domain. The third company, Wolf Carbon Solutions, proposes a shorter route in eastern Iowa that would connect 2 ethanol plants and seeks to avoid using eminent domain to obtain land easements. Nikki Cannon, a Wolf spokesperson, said the company is still working with landowners, elected officials, and others to find a palatable route. Our main goal is to not use eminent domain and instead find creative solutions that will enable this project to move forward around those who do not wish to have their land included in the pipeline route, Cannon said. The company has the ability to amend its IUB permit application to request the use of eminent domain. Pipeline opponents and others have argued that eminent domain is inappropriate for carbon dioxide pipelines because they don't benefit the public in the same way that natural gas pipelines and electricity transmission lines do. The Iowa House approved legislation this year that would have required the pipeline companies to obtain voluntary easements for 90% of their routes before they could use eminent domain for the rest, but the Senate did not take up the bill. Strikes trim profit at General Motors. Detroit. A strike auto workers against General Motors is expected to cut pre-tax earnings by $800 million this year and another $200 million per week after that, the company's chief financial officer said. Those figures include only factories that are on strike now. So if more plants are added by the United Auto Workers Union, the losses will pile up further, CEO Paul Jacobson told reporters. Shortly after the conference call with UAW expanded the strike to Arlington, Texas, one of GM's most profitable plants, 5,000 workers walked off their jobs at the factory, which makes SUVs. GM, on Tuesday, posted net income of more than $300 billion from July through September, down 7% from the same period last year, due to lost production from the strike and also increased warranty costs, Jacobson said. The company also withdrew its previous full-year pre-tax earnings estimates, citing uncertainty over the length of the strike and how many factories would be shut down. However, excluding one-time items, General Motors said it made $2.28 per share, handily beating Wall Street estimates of $1.87 revenue of $44.13 billion rose 5.4%, and also exceeded estimates of $42.48 billion, according to data provider FactSet. The UAW has been on strike since September 15th, nearly 6 weeks against General Motors and its Detroit competitors, Ford and Jeep maker Stellantis. The union had spared factories that make GM's most profitable vehicles, pickup trucks, and large SUVs from its targeted strikes. Yet the UAW is demonstrating this week that risks to those money-making facilities can rise the longer the strike goes on. On Monday, the union shut down Stellantis' huge Ram pickup truck plant north of Detroit in Sterling Heights, Michigan. 2 weeks ago, workers walked off their jobs at Ford's largest and most profitable plant, one that makes pickups and big SUVs in Louisville, Kentucky. So far, only 28% of the union's 146,000 members at the Detroit 3 are on strike. Jacobson said the third quarter strike loss was $200 million, since the walkouts were only in effect the final 2 weeks of the period. He predicted another $600 million of losses from October through December. In a note to shareholders, CEO Mary Barra said GM made a record offer to the union that will raise top factory pay to $40.39 per hour, or roughly $84,000 a year in 4 years. It's an offer that rewards our team members but does not put our company and their jobs at risk. Barra wrote, accepting unsustainably high costs would put our future and General Motors team members' jobs at risk, and jeopardizing our future is something I will not do. Union President John Fain says the companies are making billions and paying millions to CEOs so they can afford to pay workers more. The three automakers amassed almost $250 billion in reported profits in their North American operations over the past decade. Edward Jones analyst Jeff Windau said investors are concerned about the financial hit from a longer strike, GM showing electric vehicle production, and whether it can squeeze out more costs cuts to offset a deal with the union. Our concern is generally making sure that automakers have that flexibility to be able to navigate through a cyclical downturn, he said Tuesday. Jacobson said many have expressed concerns about GM taking on higher labor costs, but the company planned for it by cutting in other areas. For example, GM's annual fixed costs will be $2 billion lower than 2022 by the end of 2024, Jacobson said. The company also is showing electric vehicle production to adjust the slower short-term growth in demand. Last week, General Motors announced it postponed production at one Michigan electric pickup truck factory from this year until late 2025 to keep manufacturing in line with demand. That decision will save the company $1.5 billion next year, Jacobson said. Barra said the transition to EVs will be, quote, a bit bumpy at times, but GM is prepared to react with agility. As an example, she cited the company's plan to resurrect the Chevrolet Bolt small EV, which the company was to stop making at the end of this year. Now the company will take the attributes of the current Bolt and add new battery and other technology to roll out a new vehicle in 2025. GM is sticking with plans to increase manufacturing capacity to 1 million EVs per year in North America by the end of 2025, he said. But earlier guidance of building 400,000 EVs in North America through the middle of next year were scrapped. Jacobson said GM still expects to start turning low to mid single-digit profit margins on electric vehicles in 2025. Demand for vehicles and prices remained strong through a third quarter, which helped keep GM's profit high. The company's U.S. sales rose 21%, and Jacobson said the average U.S. selling price for GM vehicles was $50,750, down only slightly from the previous quarter. So far, the consumer has held up remarkably well for us, as evidenced by the average transaction prices, Jacobson said. They continue to hang in, and I think exceeded most expectations that were set at the beginning of the year. War could push shift to renewables, IEA says. Frankfurt, Germany tensions from the war in Gaza could help accelerate the move away from planet-warming fossil fuels like oil and gas and toward renewable energy, electric cars, and heat pumps, similar to how sharp increases in the price of oil during the 1970s unleashed efforts to conserve fuel, head of the International Energy Agency said. Today we are again facing a crisis in the Middle East that could once again shock oil markets, said IEA Executive Director Fatih Birol. That comes on top of the stress of energy markets from Russia's cutoff of natural gas to Europe over its invasion of Ukraine, he said. Put these two things together and no one can convince me that oil and gas are safe. and secure energy choices for countries or consumers, Birol told the Associated Press ahead of the publication Tuesday of the IEA's annual World Energy Outlook, which analyzes the global picture of energy supply and demand. This could further accelerate the energy transition around the world, with renewable resources like wind, solar, offering a long-lasting solution to energy security issues as well as climate change, he said. The attack on Israel by the militant organization Hamas and the ensuing Israeli military siege raised fears of a wider Mideast conflict. So far, oil prices rises have been relatively moderate. International benchmark Brent crude traded at $90.17 per barrel Tuesday, up from about $84 on the eve of the Hamas attack. Fossil fuel prices are down from 2022 peaks, but markets are tense and volatile, the IEA report said. Some of the immediate pressures from the global energy crisis have eased, but energy markets, geopolitics, and the global economy are unsettled, and the risk of further disruption is ever present, it said. Birol pointed out that there was a major government response to the energy supply concerns that arose 50 years ago from the Arab oil embargo imposed during the 1973 Yom Kippur War. It sent oil prices almost 300% higher and led to the founding of the IEA in 1974 to help shape a collective response to the disruption. That was followed by the 1978 Iranian Revolution, which added another price shock at the time. The solutions included the rollout of nuclear power plants and the imposition of mileage standards for cars. This time, we have all the available technologies, Birol said. We have solar, wind, nuclear power, electric cars. They will extend significantly around the world, and it will be an additional boost to the energy transition. He pointed to the rapid rollout of electric cars, saying that in 2020, only 1 in 25 cars was electric, but in 2023, it was 1 in 5. Meanwhile, the share of fossil fuels in electricity generation fell from 70% 10 years ago to 60% today and should reach 40% by 2023, he said. Concerted international action at the upcoming United Nations Climate Conference is needed to expand the use of clean technologies and find new ways of financing the massive investment that is needed, especially in the developing world, the IEA said. The report also pointed to a shifting role for China. Once a leading source of increased demand for energy due to rapid industrialization and growth, the report said energy demand there could peak as soon as 2025 amid slowing growth and impressive shifts to clean energy like solar and nuclear. The IEA estimates that demand for fossil fuels will peak before 2030 under current policies, but says governments will have to increase their efforts to speed up the transition if the world is to meet the global goal of keeping warming down 1.5 degrees Celsius. Israel launches barrage. Health authorities in Gaza say hundreds of Palestinians are dead. Rafah, Gaza Strip, Israeli escalated airstrikes across the Gaza Strip on Tuesday, crushing families in the rubble of the residential buildings. As health officials said, hundreds of Palestinians were killed and medical facilities were shut down because of bomb damage and lack of power. The soaring death toll from Israeli's bombardment is unprecedented in the decades-long Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Augurs an even greater loss of life in Gaza once Israeli forces backed by tanks and artillery launch an expected ground offensive aiming at crushing Hamas militants. Gaza's 2.3 million people have been running out of food, water, and medicine since Israel sealed off the territory after the devastating October 7th attack by Hamas on towns in southern Israel. The Gaza Health Ministry, which is run by Hamas and Israeli airstrikes, killed at least 704 people over the prior day, mostly women and children. The AP could not independently verify the death tolls cited by Hamas, which it says tallies figures from hospital directors. Israeli said Tuesday it launched 400 airstrikes over the prior day, a group of Hamas divers that tried to infiltrate Israel on a beach just north of Gaza. On Tuesday, were confronted by naval forces, the Israeli military said. Across central and south Gaza, where Israel previously told civilians to take shelter, There were scenes of rescuers pulling the dead and wounded out of large piles of rubble from collapsed buildings. Graphic photos and videos shot by the Associated Press showed rescuers unearthing bodies of children from multiple ruins. Buildings that collapsed on residents killed dozens at a time in several cases, witnesses said. A strike on a four-story building in Khan Yunis killed at least 32 people, including 13 members of the Sokwala family, said Amar Albuda, a relative who survived the airstrike. He said there were about 100 people sheltering in the building, including many who evacuated from Gaza City. We thought that our area would be safe, he said. The health ministry said more than 5,700 Palestinians have been killed in the war, including some 2,300 minors. The fighting killed more than 1,400 people in Israel, mostly civilians slain during the militia Hamas attack, according to the Israeli government. Israel claims it does not target civilians and that Hamas militants are using them as cover for their attacks. Palestinian militants fired more than 7,000 rockets at Israel since the start of the war, according to Israel, and Hamas said it fired a fresh barrage on Tuesday. Trump fixer appears in court. Cohen testifies he was told to infiltrate values of properties, quote, arbitrarily. In New York, in a courtroom showdown 5 years in the making, Donald Trump's fixer turned foe. Michael Cohen testified Tuesday he worked to boost the supposed value of the former president as sets to, quote, whatever number Trump told us to. It was a long-awaited face-to-face encounter between Trump and the now-disbarred lawyer. Cohen eventually ended up in prison and became a prominent witness against his former boss from the courthouse to Congress. Cohen is a key figure in New York Attorney General Lydia James' lawsuit alleging that Trump and his company duped banks, insurers, and others by giving them financial statements that infiltrated his wealth. I was tasked by Mr. Trump to increase the total assets based on a number that he arbitrarily elected. Cohen testified saying he and former Trump Organization finance chief Alan Weisenberg labored to revise engineer the various different asset classes, increase those assets in order to achieve a number that Mr. Trump had tasked us. Trump denies James' allegations and dismissed Cohen's account outside the court as the words of a proven liar, quote, who served a prison time after pleading guilty to tax evasion, lying to Congress, and campaign finance violations. The former president and Republican 2024 frontrunner voluntarily came up to court for the anticipated testimony. Cohen previously said he hadn't seen Trump for 5 years until now. Judge Arthur Engoron already ruled that Trump and his company committed fraud, but the trial involves remaining claims of conspiracy, insurance fraud, and falsifying business records. Trump says his assets were actually undervalued, and he maintains that disclaimers on his financial statements essentially told recipients to check the numbers out for themselves. Cohen spent a decade as Trump's fiercely loyal personal lawyer before famously breaking with him in 2018 amid a federal investigation that sent Cohen to federal prison. He is also a major prosecution witness in Trump's separate Manhattan hush money criminal case, which is scheduled to go to trial next spring. James credited Cohen as the impetus for her civil investigation, which led to the fraud lawsuit and trial. Republicans nominate Johnson for Speaker. House GOP tries a fourth time to pick a leader after Emmer bows out. Washington, House Republicans chose Representative Mike Johnson as their nominee for House Speaker Tuesday after an earlier pick, Representative Tom Emmer, abruptly withdrew in the face of opposition from Donald Trump. The hardline GOP lawmakers, Johnson of Louisiana, is a member of the House GOP leadership, a lawyer specializing in constitutional issues, who rallied Republicans around Trump's legal effort to overturn true 2020 election results. Republicans met late into Tuesday night behind closed doors, desperate to find a leader who can unite the factions, reopen the House, and get the U.S. Congress working again after hard right members of the party ousted Kevin McCarthy of California from the job 3 weeks ago Emmer of Minnesota, the GOP whip, was the third House Republican to fall short in political infighting, but said Trump's opposition did not affect his decision to bow out. While Emmer won a simple majority in a roll call behind closed doors, 117 votes, he lost more than two dozen Republicans, leaving him far short of what will be needed during a House floor tally to be Speaker. Another Trump lawyer strikes a deal with the state. Attorney and conservative media figure Jenna Ellis pleaded guilty Tuesday to a felony charge over efforts to overturn Donald Trump's 2020 election loss in Georgia, tearfully telling the judge she looks back on that time with deep remorse. Quote, Ellis, the fourth defendant in the case to enter into a plea deal with prosecutors, was a vocal part of Trump's re-election campaign in the last presidential cycle and was charged alongside the Republican former president and 17 others with violating the state's anti-racketeering law. Ellis pleading guilty to one felony count of aiding and abetting false statements and writings. She was facing charges of violating Georgia's Racketeering Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, known as RICO, and soliciting the violation of oath by a public officer, both felonies. Ellis's guilty plea comes just days after two other defendants, fellow attorneys Sidney Powell and Kenneth Chesbrough, entered guilty pleas. That means three high-profile people responsible for pushing baseless legal challenges to Democrat Joe Biden's 2020 election victory have agreed to accept responsibility. D-backs stunned Phillies claim NLCS. Philadelphia Corbin Carroll went 3-for-4 with two RBIs and two runs scored, and the Arizona Diamondbacks advanced to the World Series for the first time in 22 years Tuesday night by stunning the Philadelphia Phillies 4-2 in Game 7 of the NFL Championship Series. Arizona plays the Texas Rangers in the World Series and the Game 1 set on Friday night at the Globe Field. In their only other trip to the Fall Classic, the Diamondbacks won a 7-game thriller against the New York Yankees in 2001. The young Diamondbacks, who were at 84-78, squeezed into the playoffs as the final NL wild card, completed their comeback with a 0-2 hole in the NLCS. They won games 6 and 7 in Philadelphia, where the defending National League champions had been 12-2 over the past two postseasons, including 11-0 in NFL playoffs. Brandon Pafat struck out 7 in 4 innings and 5 relievers combined to pitch their way out of late inning jams for the surprising NL pennant winners. Bryce Harper and the rest of the Phillies are forced to ponder this offseason how they let a second straight World Series trip slip away. Philadelphia returned home a win from a pennant, but couldn't close it out, falling behind in early Game 6 and then losing the first Game 7 in 141-year history of the franchise. Kevin Ginkle, the fourth reliever for Arizona, showed his mettle with an absolutely gutsy seventh after left-hander Andrew LeFranc walked consecutive batters with one out. Ginkle entered the retired Trey Turner and Harper on flyouts to center field. Ginkle then struck out all three batters in the eighth, and Paul Sewald pitched a perfect ninth for his sixth save in his postseason. Arizona's bullpen slammed the door on Philadelphia's powerful lineup. The shushed Phillies fans would soon be weeping of their own. Again, the Diamondbacks struck first when Christian Walker grounded into a fielder's choice against Phillies starter Ranger Suarez in a first inning for a 1-0 lead. It may have seemed like a rather innocuous run, but Arizona was already 5-0 postseason. When it scored first and the run, much as the Diamondbacks did, with a 3-run second game 6, deflated its boisterous crowd that came prepared for a clinch. Well, Phillies fans did see one, just not the pennant winner they paid to watch at Citizens Bank Park. Pafat, who struck out 9 in Game 3, allowed Alec Bohm's trying solo homer in the second that put a jolt in the crowd and a needed one into the offense. Bohm pointed to his right ring finger, symbolizing the World Series bling he wanted to win. Bohm was at it again in the fourth when he walked and scored on Bryson Scott's double for a 2-1 lead. But the free-swinging Phillies let prime opportunities go to waste. With runners on the corners, Nick Castellanos struck out at the point 0 for 21 with 11 strikeouts. Since a Game 1 homer and after a walk to Brandon Marsh-Joanne, Rojas struck out to the end of the fourth. Suarez struck out Ketel Marte for the third straight time in fifth to make it two outs with a runner on second. Carroll, just 3-for-23 in the six games of the series, lined an RBI single for his third hit of the Game 7 that chased Suarez. Gabriel Moreno made it 3-2 with a single off Jeff Hoffman, and the Diamondbacks never looked back. Promising news on fat from natural cheese. The Wisconsin license plate on a car that passed me on the highway said it all. Say cheese, I smiled. More than 180 years ago, Wisconsin farmers began making cheese to preserve excess milk from their cows. Today, according to the United States Department of Agriculture, Wisconsin is the top cheese-producing state, followed by California, Idaho, and New Mexico. I'm a native of this state, so I don't know that cheese is a staple in many New Mexican dishes. Queso Blanco, for example, is a soft, crunchy white cheese, often melted into sauces to top enchiladas or crumbled over beans, tacos, or huevos rancheros. Other cheese inspired by Spanish-speaking cultures include queso para frir, cheese that is fried, a favorite in the Caribbean and Central America. This mild-tasting cheese is also used in sandwiches and baked dishes. According to Goyo Foods, the largest Hispanic-owned food company in the United States, how does the culturally diverse food fit into a healthful diet? Cheese is in the dietary group, one of six core elements that make up a healthy dietary pattern, according to the 2020 to 2025 Dietary Guidelines for Americans. While this report generally recommends lower fat versions, with some intriguing research suggests traditional cheeses may also be reasonable choices. Natural cheese is a fermented food made with milk, salt, probiotics, aka good bacteria, and rennet, an enzyme that causes milk protein to form curds. A 2022 review in the journal Microorganisms includes cheese as a traditional fermented food. Studies from around the world, these authors say, revealed strong associations between fermented foods and reduced risk of heart disease, diabetes, as well as a lower risk of death. Cheese is also a significant source of saturated fat, which we are called to limit in our diets. Evidence is emerging, however, that we may need to judge the saturated fat in foods by the company they keep. For example, a 2022 research article in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition reported that a higher intake of saturated fat from dairy foods had less of an impact on heart disease than a lower intake of these foods, especially in males. While not statistically significant, the same intake of saturated fats from non-dairy foods did not have the same favorable outcomes. How can this be? We don't know for sure, but some research suggests that the mix of calcium and other nutrients in cheese may reduce how much fat we absorb from these foods, says the National Dairy Council, a nonprofit dairy nutrition research and education organization. At any rate, remember that a serving of natural cheese is about 1.5 ounces or a third a cup shredded. As always, moderation is key. Barbara Intermill is a registered dietitian. Email her at barbara@qinnessentialnutrition.com. Tom Brady and Arena Shake have ended their romance. The relationship between the 46-year-old former NFL star and the 37-year-old model, which heated up in July with dates in Los Angeles and London, fizzled out, quote-unquote, in recent weeks, according to TMZ. The outlet reports that there was no drama or scandal as they decided to go their separate ways. Arena previously dated Bradley Cooper from 2015 until 2019, and they've managed to maintain a healthy relationship since their breakup for the sake of their daughter. The model previously opened up about their co-parenting dynamic in an essay for Harper's Bazaar, revealing that they'd been teaching their daughter about kindness. The brunette beauty wrote in this essay, "We're teaching our daughter that the most important thing is to be kind to people. Every time we send her to school, we're like, just remember, kindness and love." Duran Duran rejected Christmas song idea. Council Bluffs 5-day forecast. Today is rather cloudy with a shower. Wind blowing southeast at 7 to 14 miles per hour and 72 degrees. Tonight, rain and thunderstorms and a wind blowing southward between 8 miles and 16 miles per hour at 63 degrees. Thursday, a shower and thunderstorm, winds blowing southwest and 10 to 20 miles per hour. There is a high of 68 degrees and a low of 42. Friday, it's going to be windy and cooler, with wind blowing northwest of 10 and 20 mile per hour. And then there is a high of 49 degrees and a low of 31 degrees. And then Saturday will be cooler with a few showers, with wind blowing northeast with 7 to 14 mile per hour winds blowing in a northeast direction. And there is a high of 39 degrees and a low of 27. Sunday, it will be mostly cloudy and cold, with a wind of northwest direction between 8 and 16 miles per hour, and a high of 35 degrees and a low of 23. Do white sneakers go with everything? Dear answer, Angel Ellen, are there any limits on where you can wear white sneakers? They seem to be turning up everywhere, with tuxedos at weddings, with formal gowns. It seems like a huge mismatch to see white tennis shoes paired with chiffon and cummerbunds. Am I just out of it? Jenny P. said. Dear Jenny, you are the opposite of out of it. Wearing white sneakers with everything is a style trend rocketing through the celebrity world and trickling down to us commoners. Fans include Taylor Swift, various Kardashians, multiple models, Michelle Obama, Hulk Hogan, Emma Blunt, Spike Lee, and many more. Personally, I wouldn't wear white sneakers or any sneakers to, say, a meeting at the White House or a formal event. But in general, I am a big fan of trends that coincide with comfort. Because I am not a fan of hitchhiking boots or UGG-type boots with shorts or even with dresses, styles that are turning up on Pinterest, I would vote for white sneakers over those looks for sure. Even some snooty restaurants and clubs have had to yield to the tsunami of the white sneaker style. To state the obvious, once cold weather arrives, for those of us who had to endure snow and ice, it's back to the boots and parkas.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland and is used today around the world and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For EarthDate, I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.
I'm getting older. Do I need to worry about falling?
Yes, you do. Every year, 1 in 4 people 65 and older will experience a fall, and many result in serious injury. The majority of falls happen at home. So take a look around. Replace bulbs and add lighting to help you see obstacles. Remove things that can make you trip. Fix uneven steps and floors. And install handrails in bathrooms and on stairs. Consider balance or strength training exercises, which can help with agility. Get your eyes and hearing checked regularly. Changes in your hearing can affect your balance. To learn more, please talk to your doctor about steps you can take to help prevent a fall. You can also visit aarpfoundation.org or medicaremadeclear.com/falls. This message was brought to you by UnitedHealthcare and AARP Foundation.